graced with two new people, Robin Koning from Down Under, and Hans van Nguyen, so welcome to the city. Those of you who ordered MP3s of Lonergan's lectures on insight, the lectures that he gave in 1958 at Halifax, the first 4 days of those lectures, August 4th to August 7th, 1958, are available on the CDs that Greg has here. That's about 10 hours of listening to the Lonergan lecture. If you didn't order it last week and would like to place an order, Greg says it's relatively easy to make some more.
Just in case anyone didn't understand last week, these are MP3 files. Anyone that ordered one, so if you didn't, if you were thinking you were getting like an audio CD that you could play in your regular CD player, if you want to sort of like back out, now's your chance.
But MP3 means they can only use it on a computer.
Yeah. Yeah, you can. You have to play it. Yeah.
There are some CD players.
Like portable MP3 players. Yeah, they play both CDs and MP3 files. But otherwise, you have to play it on your computer. That and just click on the file, and it'll automatically bring up your media player. So it's pretty straightforward. Just click on the file, and the computer will do the rest.
Okay. Thank you for doing that. It is a good experience. I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to listen to an author talking about his own book. And it's new. I'm excited. I'm very excited by the audio project that we got. I was just lucky enough to have 500 hours of one of his lectures over the years, all spread out over 25 years. So it really adds a whole other dimension to the total, the opera omnia, if you want, in addition to the print. We'll never know what Aristotle sounded like, or Thomas Aquinas, or Immanuel Kant. If we do this right, we will know what Bernard Lonergan sounded like for many, many centuries to come. Okay, so, and the other two handouts were just notices of events. We have an annual Bernard Lonergan event every year. Did everybody get that on November the 7th? We all got that. And then the seminars, which I mentioned last week. So you're all invited, and don't be put off when it says graduate seminars. You're all graduate students, and MDiv students are graduate students. So anybody who's coming to this class, you're most welcome to be there. All right, so I'm ready to dive into the preface and the introduction, and we'll follow the method that I've used in teaching this course in the past, namely the handouts will form the basis of the discussion, we'll see. If you want to change the method at any point as we go along, I'm most open to doing that, but I know that I've found in the past that this is one way that seems to work with a group of students. What I'd like to do is to proceed as follows today. This is on the preface and the introduction. I'd like to cover the first five items first, and then we'll pause and see if there's a need for discussion on that. This is just to make sure that we do our best to try to cover as much as possible in the material. And then go down, after a pause for a discussion, then go down to item number 9. And we'll pause for discussion again at that point and take a break, 10-minute break after number 9, and then we'll come back and we'll do 10, 11, 12, pause for discussion there, and then the rest of the material. So that's just the way I'll try to break it down, and just to make sure that we don't get too scattered, and yet at the same time that we leave room for discussion as much as possible. So the book itself, then, is an invitation. It's an invitation to embark on a process. And the process in this book is called the self-appropriation of one's own rational self-consciousness. The term rational self-consciousness is not a term that Lonergan will use in his later writing. He'll talk about the self-appropriation of conscious intentionality. It changes word and changes. But in this book, as you have seen already, in the preface in the introduction, the term that is used is the self-appropriation of one's rational self-consciousness. And one begins this process by coming into reflective and explanatory possession. Come back to that in a moment. Explanatory possession of the operations that constitute oneself as a knower. So explanatory means relating those operations to one another. Lonergan will distinguish, as we'll see quite soon in the book, between description and explanation. They're both knowing, they both involve understanding, both involve judgment. But description is relating things to us, the way things are related to us. And explanation is relating things to one another. So what he's aiming at, and he gets there very quickly in the first chapter, is an explanatory understanding of the operations that constitute each of us as knowers, relating those operations to one another. So it's not simply how we experience them. That would be description, but how they are related to one another. How sense, image, question, insight, concept, and so on are related to one another. He'll start with the experience of insight, and he'll give a description of what that experience is, and he'll move very quickly into the realm of exploration. Some people have said, and some scholastic philosophers have said, that Lonergan is Kantian. I think that nothing could be farther from the truth, but if you start with an emphasis on the subject, for a number of people in the scholastic tradition, and very sincere people, and I'm not trying to downplay their concerns about the sort of thing that Lonergan is doing, but for them that's Kantian, it's idealistic. Once you get in, you'll never get out. If you start inside, you'll never get out into that real world, which of course is out there for them. But for Kant, another distinction between Kant and Lonergan, the main distinction is that for Kant, the first question was, what are the conditions of valid knowing? And for Lonergan, there's a prior question, and that's the one that he's doing and that he's concerned with in this book, and particularly in part one, what am I doing when I'm knowing? What's going on? What are the operations? It's a very concrete question. It's not, first of all, that transcendental question of what are the conditions of the possibility of valid knowing. That's the second question, that's epistemology. But the first question is, what's going on? What's happening? What am I doing when I'm doing? The second question is, why is doing that knowing, which is equivalent to Kant's question of the conditions of valid knowing, why is doing that knowing? But you've got a that there. You've got a set of operations and you've already related them to one another. Why is doing that knowing? That's the question for epistemology. And then the third basic question is, what do I know when I do that? So what am I doing when I am knowing? And that's basically chapters 1 to 11 in the book. And the question is answered in chapter 11. You're building up to the answer through the first 10 chapters. What am I doing when I am knowing? Why is doing that knowing? Why is that really knowing? Chapters 12 and 13 on being and objectivity. So chapters 12 and 13 answer the second question. That's the question for epistemology. His first question is what he calls the question for cognitional theory. Second basic question in philosophy is the question for epistemology. Why is doing that knowing? Why can I say that when I do that, I'm knowing? And then the third basic question is the question for metaphysics. What do I know then I do that. For him, all through his writings, those are the three basic philosophical questions. And then on those questions, on the answers to those questions, one moves on to an ethics, political philosophy, philosophy of God, philosophy of religion, and then into theology. But those are the three basic philosophical questions. What am I doing when I'm knowing? Why is doing that knowing? What do I know when I do it? And it breaks down to chapters 1 to 11 on cognitional theory, 12 and 13 on epistemology, 14 to 17 on metaphysics, and then he moves on in 18 to ethics, and 19 and 20 to theology, philosophy of God and theology, philosophy of God in chapter 19. Theology moving into the need for something more, revelation and so on, chapter 20 of the epilogue. Okay, so number two then, central to the operations, what I'm doing, central to those is the frequently neglected act that he calls insight. The act of insight, to use the instance that he starts with, the detective story, the detective, gets the answer to the mystery. The act of insight is not the mere apprehension of any clue. That's just the beginning of insight. If you grasp something as a clue, well, you might be on your way, but you might be getting sidetracked. It's not the mere apprehension of any clue. It's not the mere memory of all the clues. Something distinct. It's a quite distinct activity of organizing intelligence that places the full set of clues in a unique explanatory perspective. It's at that point that your Sherlock Holmes or Rebus, if you're reading Rankin, says, "I've got it." And it's the "I've got it" that Bowman means by insight. The experience where you say, "I've got it, Eureka." The release to the tension of inquiry that comes when everything falls into perspective. Again, insight is not any act of attention, advertence, memory. Those are all at the empirical level of consciousness, experience. And this goes beyond. This takes experience and sublates it, to use one of his later terms, into a higher integration that is brought by understanding. So it's distinct from and beyond attention, advertence, memory, but the supervening act of understanding. Cognitional theory begins, you'll see next week in chapter 1, with a description of the act of insight, and then an explanatory account that begins to relate that act to its antecedents and its consequence, to what comes before it and to what follows upon it. I think I should comment for a moment on this word organizing, the act of organizing intelligence, and the epistemological problems that that can bring to some people in the scholastic tradition. Lonergan said once you admit that what Thomas meant by intellectus, intellect, is what is the same thing as psychologists mean by intelligence, then you're into a range of epistemological problems. The fact is that insight is constructive. It's creative. It puts things together. And a lot of the scholastic tradition has been wary of acknowledging the importance of an act that itself is constructive and creative. Because then there's a question of, well, does that mean that all we know is what we ourselves have constructed? All we know are our own ideas. We may be very creative, but how do we know that it's true? And so there's the epistemological questions that are raised for a number of people in the scholastic tradition
putting an emphasis on an act that itself organizes, or more than organizes, it really constructs and creates. And there's the fear among a number of scholastic philosophers that once you make that central to know, the constructive, creative activity of the human mind, that you're running the danger of idealism. And the reason for the difficulty in the scholastic tradition is that for many people in that tradition, and I'm thinking of really extremely qualified people like Étienne Gilson, as a historian, he's probably the best historian of medieval Christian thought in the past century. But for him, the act of judgment is at the beginning of the cognitional process. Right? And for Lonergan, the act of judgment follows upon understanding. So we'll see when we get to the end of the introduction, Lonergan will talk about something that looks like idealism, but if you stopped right here, it would be idealism. If you stopped with the emphasis on the organizing and creative and constructive act of human intelligence, then we're creating a world, and all we know are the ideas that we ourselves have created. But if you say then that after that, there's a further question, is it true? And that further question that follows upon understanding is what gives rise to the judgment, yes or no. And it is only with that judgment, yes or no, that I know what is. And you're beyond idealism. But you're beyond idealism by going through it, as it were, rather than by stopping short of it. By going through the creative and constructive and organizing activities of your own intelligence, rather than by not acknowledging. I hope that that's clear. Yes, Chris.
I ran into a bit of misunderstanding on this point, but just right from the get-go, doing the reading for this. It stemmed from when you, in the last class, brought up the diagram on the board of sense, image, insight, inner word of understanding, and then on to judgment. And so to me then, insight and that scheme is preceding the inner word of understanding.
It's preceding, insight is understanding.
Okay.
The inner word follows from that. The inner word is concept.
Right.
So the first inner word is the concept that follows upon understanding.
Right. So then what the confusion that came to me then is if it precedes the concept, I identified like this kind of aha, like you're talking about that the insight is just the kind of aha that we come to when things have been organized and collected together. That sounds to me like, that aha sounds to me like it's at the end of judgment, like I've made an affirmation, aha, this thing's true. Or at least a conception. Aha, here's the thing. But at the level of insight, before conception, am I saying aha? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
That's how I got confused.
I know exactly what you're saying, but you know, every insight and every aha experience could still be just a bright idea. Lonergan's famous line, I mean, it's so famous that people make all kinds of jokes about it, his insights are a dime a dozen. Somebody said, "Dime a dozen, I paid $25 for one." And then the problem is figuring out which ones are right. You can get all excited about an insight and an aha experience, but then you test it and it leads nowhere.
Okay.
So, and it's the testing that leads to judgment. And the judgment can be a very quiet. Judgment doesn't necessarily have the excitement of the insight.
Mm-hmm.
The judgment is.
But when you say you're referring to this insight, maybe I'm just splitting hairs here. We're talking about a concept here. In other words,
you're not talking about a concept. You're talking about something that the concept emerges with the insight.
Okay.
What he wants you to get, and what I want you to get, is that there is a distinction between the two.
Okay.
And I brought Aquinas along with me, and I was going to refer to him later at this point. So let me do it.
because it's also, it's, this is in Thomas's first question on the Trinitarian processions, question 27, article 1, in the first part of the Summa Theologiae, because this is Thomas's analog for the procession of the word, is from insight to concept.
Right. Right. Intelligible and nation.
Yeah, this is it, and this is the analog that he uses for the procession of the word.
I'm with you. Like, I understand the diagram. What I don't understand is when you talk about having a bright idea. I hear a concept when you tell me this bright idea. I mean, it may not be true, but
a concept emerges with the insight, and then it emerges with it. But there's a distinction.
Yeah,
and the act of understanding is the source of the concept. And the concept, then you go to work on the concept and you make it ever clearer. You see, I've got it. What have you got? Well, it's got this and it's got this and that. And then you clarify it by bit by bit. But you've already got something. See? And something's emerged with that so that you can begin to talk about it. And what's emerged with it is the beginning of conceptualization. But then you've got to think it through and get your concepts clear.
So the bright idea is the concept.
Pardon me?
The bright idea is the
concept. Well, as an idea, it's a concept.
Yeah.
But the
as bright, it's a
the light is the insight. Okay? The thing that enables you to say, I've got it. Okay? It's the insight. Thomas says here, this is in question 27. And this is so important, and it's so missed by so many people. The Latin is whoever understands, intelligent now. For this is another point with Lauterman and the Verbum studies of Aquinas, that the word intelligere in Aquinas does not mean think. Okay. The word intelligere in Thomas means to understand. Okay. Whoever understands, or if anyone understands, from the very fact that that person understands, there proceeds within that person, cogitat aliquid, something within that person, which is the conception of the thing understood. Right? So from the very fact that someone understands, there proceeds within that person, cogitat intra ipsum aliquid, something, quod est conceptio rei intellecti, which is the conception of the thing that has been understood. It proceeds ex vi intellectiva proveniens, coming forth from the power of intelligence, right? And from the knowledge that's contained in the insight. That is the human analog for the procession of the divine word. That from the ipsum intelligere, which is the Father, well, God is ipsum intelligere, but the Father is ipsum intelligere qua dicens, as speaking, and the verbum is the word that is spoken by the infinite act of understanding. So this is the for the first term. Does that help?
It does.
Back to distinction between insight and concept.
Yeah.
Are we saying that insight is the product of an unconscious process, and as it becomes conscious, the conscious processing is the concept?
No. What we're saying is that insight is the product of a preconceptual conscious process.
Okay.
Not preconceptual, but it is conscious. A conscious process is you're conscious as you want to know. And insights have a tendency not to emerge if you don't care whether you have them or not. So there's a caring, there's a desire to know. And that's what he'll focus on very early on in chapter 1. What gives rise to the insight is this hunger or thirst or whatever metaphor you want to use for knowledge, to know. So the desire to know the question or consciousness as a pure question, but consciousness, not unconscious. Oh, does it emerge ultimately out of the unconscious? Yeah, because there's a vertical finality of the whole of our being to the ends of the human spirit, to truth, to the intelligible, the true, and the good, transcendentals. So our whole being thrives on truth. It does. And so there is an unconscious yearning for it. but the there's a conscious process, which we experience as raising questions.
But it starts from the level of pre-consciousness, that's what you're saying.
The whole thing starts from the pre-conscious, yeah. And when we get into chapter 6, where he's dealing with the questions that have been raised by Freud and psychoanalysis, he'll give his own spin on that and relate it to insight. But his main concern is that there's a condition within each one of us for the emergence of insight, which is the conscious desire for it. And that's a precondition for an emergence. So, good. All right, so then, number 3, the act then to which the book is calling our attention receives, Lonergan says, little attention from philosophers, but its function in cognitional theory is so central that to grasp it in its conditions, like the desire to know, its working and its results, is to confer a basic yet startling unity on the whole field of human inquiry and human opinion. Now, this is a claim that he's making, and he's asking you to test it. You can't really make a judgment on a claim like that when you're reading it on page 3 of the book. Okay, you have to see whether or not, yeah, does it really do that? Because if it does, that's really something that can be fairly important. And then we have that quote that I gave you last year about the world lying in pieces before us and pleading to be put together again. The desire for a unity to overcome the fragmentation of knowledge, which we can no longer do on the basis of content, but might we do it on the basis of operations? Okay? Could there be a movement to reaching some kind of plateau of meaning? Meaning is monitored by the self-appropriation of the operations by which we come to know. So the point of the book then is not understanding sets of elements as in mathematics, or ranges of phenomena as in physics, or concrete situations as in common sense, but rather understanding, insight into insight. The effort is to reach the act of organizing intelligence that brings within a single perspective the insights of mathematicians, scientists, and people of common sense. And then finally, and then we can pause once again and see whether we've got any further questions. Why the order? A lot of people say, why do you have to start with mathematics and physics? Well, if only those, and I mean, my own experience is I started the book 5 times at the design, because I don't have a strong background in math and physics. But I knew there was something there that I wanted. And so I finally said, I'm just going to read it, that's all. Let it fall in place as it will. But why that? You know, it's a tough beginning, the first 5 chapters. Well, he says, the precise nature of the act of understanding is to be seen most clearly in mathematical examples. Now, many people will say, well, maybe that was true for him. Because he did have a mathematical mind. But anyway, that's what he chose to do. The dynamic context in which understanding occurs can be studied to best advantage in an investigation of scientific methods. Because science is really very clearly intelligence on the move. You're familiar with Thomas Kuhn, whose book, of course, was after this book, which Lonergan does refer to in his later writings, with the paradigm shifts and so on. But they're all a result of intelligence on the move. The dynamic context. That it can be seen in scientific procedure. And then he says, the disturbance of that context by alien concerns is thrust upon one's attention by the manner in which various measures of common nonsense blend with common sense. So that's chapter 6 and 7. This, by the way, is not the order in which he wrote the book. I mean, this, if you read the editor's preface that Fred Crow put together, there's a number of interviews, including I mentioned in there, because I had some interviews with Lonergan in the last year of his life. And what he told me was that he wrote the chapters on common sense before he wrote the chapters on science. And what I think he wrote was common sense and judgment. 6, 7, 9, and 10. And then felt that he had to give a precision and a rigor to what he was trying to say there by showing that he did have the familiarity with what was happening in modern science, and so he went back and did that with abandon in the first five chapters. Sort of almost overkill for 11, but that's the way it is. And I mean, many of you may appreciate it, and I appreciate it very much, all the more I read it, but it's still the hardest part of the book for me. the hardest thing about teaching this course is that I have to start with those chapters, because they are the most difficult for me to consider. Okay, can we pause again to see where we are if we need to. Okay, number six. Since insight is not only a mental activity but also a constituent factor in human knowledge, so it's not just one activity but a constituent factor in a whole range of activities, insight into insight will yield a knowledge of knowledge. Because if you understand insight and its relation to all these other operations, then you are coming to know knowledge itself. That will go to the core of a whole series of basic problems in philosophy. Again, a claim. But the core that it will go to will mediate problems that are raised by empiricism, idealism, relativism, subjectivism. And the first six of these are philosophical in the strictest traditional sense. They're concerned with issues of knowing and being, and they can be listed as follows. And all I want to do now is just list them, because if we stop and answer each question, it would take the rest of the course just to do that. And these are some of the questions that will be treated in the course of reading the book. What is the source of clear and distinct ideas? That shouldn't be ideal. It should be ideas. I'll read this over. I noticed as I was reading for this. Why it is not sufficient just to use a spell check. Ideal will not show up on a spell check. What is the source of clear and distinct ideas? Intellectualism versus conceptualism. Insight, okay, is the source of clear and distinct ideas. What is the meaning of meaning? There's a whole set of hermeneutical questions that are dealt with, particularly in chapter 17. What is the range of synthetic a priori components in knowing? Now, a lot of scholastics would say, please God, there aren't any. But we beg to differ on that. There are synthetic a priori components in knowing, and to acknowledge them does not mean that you have to end up a Kantian, an idealist at all. What's a priori is the desire to know, and the structure. The structure is one that proceeds by questioning through insight. So, how does one construct a philosophy? How does one construct a metaphysics? How does one, this is a big one, how does one verify a philosophy and a metaphysics? And here he's making a major statement, and the same thing will come up in method and theology in a different context. Every statement in philosophy and metaphysics can be shown to imply statements regarding cognitional fact and thus be verified. For every term and relation, this is the quotation from Method and Theology, for every term and relation, there will be a corresponding element in intentional consciousness. That corresponding element will be the source of the validity of the terms and relations that one is using and speaking there in their systematic theology. In other words, interiority is the maieutic, if you want. It's the midwifing of meaning. And the terms that are used, that are employed in philosophy and metaphysics and in systematic theology, statement that he will be making in method of theology, will find their verification in interiority, in interiorly and religiously differentiated consciousness. In religious experience, for theology, you must have that. In religious experience and in the structure of human interiority, intentionality, structure of human knowing, and so on. So the verification will be in the fact that the statements that one is making in metaphysics will have a root in cognitional theory. Now, I'm not going to explain here today how that is the case, but just to keep it in mind that the verification is through the subject.
further philosophic implications. So those are the ones that have to do with knowing and being. Further ones are more existential. There is the contrast that he will raise early on in the book, and then it comes into prominence, especially in the chapters on common sense. The contrast between what in his later language is authenticity and unauthenticity. And here, where the emphasis is on cognition, that contrast shows up as the contrast between the dynamic context, detached and disinterested inquiry. Later, that would become self-transcendence, which is what he means by authenticity, in which insights emerge, and the contrary dynamic contexts of the flight from understanding. And so, insight into insight must include an insight into the principal devices of the flight from understanding. So now we're getting into the drama of human existence, and into the dialectic of human history. Again, the principal form of the flight from understanding that will occupy his attention in this book is its philosophic form, the neglect of insight in philosophy itself. This neglect, he says, may seem harmless, but may have long-standing consequences. And I'm going to give you one here which is relatively innocuous, but nonetheless, may give an example, a theological example. If one neglects the emanation of word from understanding, concept from understanding, inner word from understanding, one has no analogy for the divine procession of the eternal word in God. And I point here to a theologian for whom I have the greatest respect, Karl Rahner, but for all of his brilliance, Rahner admits, I don't know what Thomas is talking about by intelligible emanation. I don't know what he means by that. He could not get the Thomistrinitarian theory of intelligible emanation. And the reason for that lies, I think, at the level of cognitional theory, that insight into phantasm giving rise to concept is not in the German tradition, not in the German philosophical tradition. It's not there. It's not in the tradition in which Rahner was educated. It just has not been emphasized. And so it's just not part of the arsenal with which he comes to this. The quicumque intelligit that I read in Thomas, it's not part of his philosophical tradition. His Kantian and Hegelian background. And no matter how Thomist he was, that part of it he didn't have. He had something about knowledge and phantasm, his spirit in the world, Rahner's spirit in the world, but it's not insight. He doesn't have insight. He doesn't have intelligere as understanding. So he doesn't have the appreciation of the psychological analogy for the Trinity. If you've read any of Rahner's works on the Trinity, you see that he's constantly critical of that analogy, but then what is your analogy going to be? Don't use that one. Anyway, the consequences of each context, the dynamic context in which insights emerge, the dynamic context in which we escape insight, flee from it, they can be traced, and a philosophy can be assembled then that is at once methodical, critical, and comprehensive. That's the claim. We'll see as we read whether or not he meets the claim. Thank you. Okay, two more points, and then we can pause, and then after the pause for discussion, we can take our break. He claims as well that there are practical implications of this procedure. This procedure reveals what activity is intelligent and what is not. And so what is the source of cumulative progress? There's a whole thing in Lonergan on the theory of history. For him, it goes back to work that he did in the late 1930s, which only come to light actually since his death, we discovered among his papers a whole series of things in the philosophy of history. But even in his published work, developments upon these papers from the 1930s, history for Lonergan is simultaneous functioning, if you want, of processes of progress, decline, and redemption. It's not like progress happens first, then we goof it up, and then God jumps in and redeems it. It's not a temporal sequence like that. But at one and the same time in human history, there are the forces of progress, the forces of decline, and God's grace redeeming. And progress, cumulative progress, Lonergan understands very much the way I've got it here. It's a course of events that goes something like this. Situations, insights, policies, actions, new situations, further insights, better policies, more effective action, etc., etc., etc. Cumulative decline, situations, flight from understanding, blocking needed insights, unintelligent policies, inept courses of action, deteriorating situation, still further insights, blocked, more unintelligent policies, more inept action, etc., with absurd situations seeming, providing seeming evidence for bias. Dramatically put, I'm just joking, I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but when I read this over today, no, I don't want to say.
Oh,
it reminded me of the last 8 years of government in Ontario. Anyway, so in ever increasing measure, intelligence comes to be regarded as irrelevant to practical living. Human activity settles down to a decadent routine and initiative becomes the privilege of life. So progress, decline, and redemption. And then the world historical concerns, and rather than just type out those two short paragraphs, I think we can just look at pages 8 and 9. The implications that he's claiming for all of this. Unfortunately, as insight and oversight commonly are mated, so also are progress and decline. We reinforce our love of truth with a practicality that is equivalent to an obscurantism. We correct old evils with a passion that mars the new good. We are not pure, we compromise, we hope to muddle through. But the very advance of knowledge brings a power over nature and over human beings, too vast and terrifying to be entrusted to the good intentions of unconsciously biased motives. We have to learn to distinguish sharply between progress and decline. Learn to encourage progress without putting a premium upon decline. Learn to remove the tumor of the flight from understanding without destroying the organs of intelligence. No problem is at once more delicate and more profound, more practical and perhaps more pressing. In my view, this next question is a more pressing one than it was for the book. How indeed is a mind to become conscious of its own bias when that bias springs from a conduit, flight from understanding, and is supported by the whole texture civilization? How can new strength and vigor be imparted to the detached and disinterested desire to understand without the reinforcement acting as an added bias? In other words, it can come in as an emotional sort of overlay. How can human intelligence hope to deal with the unintelligible yet objective situations which the flight from understanding creates, expands, and sustains? At least we can make a beginning by asking what precisely it is to understand, what are the dynamics of the flow of consciousness that favors insight, what are the interferences that favor oversight, what finally do the answers to such questions imply for the guidance of human thought and action. Okay, so that's the preface. I'm going to pause. We have a few minutes and we can just discuss it very briefly. Yes,
a definition of obscurantism.
Obscurantism is blocking questions. That's the basic meaning of it. And he'll, as with Lonergan's arguing distinctions, later on he'll talk about major obscurantism and minor obscurantism or something like that. But justification of not raising certain questions, to try to justify not raising certain questions. Blocking inquiry. Fear of questions. He had a great story that in the last year of his life, there was some pattern, and it falls, elderly minds can fall into this sort of thing where they repeat the same, not only the same story, but in the same words. And this happened with a lot of them, because I visited him almost every week during the last year of his life. And for a while there, for about 4 or 5 weeks running, he was telling this same story every time. And it was, I think I've got the words pretty well still. At Heathrop, he did his philosophical studies at Heathrop as a Jesuit scholastic, so this would be back in the late 1920s. At Heathrop, we had a professor named Whiteside. And Whiteside was one of three brothers in the Jesuits. And his other two brothers were on the missions. And he wanted to go to the missions and be with his brothers. But they sent him to teach philosophy to the scholastics. A fate worse than death. So what did he do? He encouraged us to ask questions. He soon got his wish and was shipped to the missions. So anyway, the obscurantism would be the people who shipped him to the missions. anything else? Yes.
I have a question. What is the Greek that Aristotle?
Oh yeah, good question. The mind grasps forms and images. This is, you're talking about the title page.
Yeah.
The subject is the ta noetikon, the knowing faculty. Noe knows, ta ede, the forms, and tois phantasmasi in images. So, and the men un is just the Greek sort of untranslatable Greek sort of transition from one sentence to another. But the subject is the ta noetikon, so the knowing faculty, the intellect, or whatever, however that is normally translated in translations of Aristotle, grasps forms in images. There are two in Verbum, Lonergan shows in Verbum, or argues in Verbum, that Thomas integrated an insight from Aristotle and an insight from Augustine. The insight from Aristotle is the grasp of intelligibility in images. That's Aristotelian, as opposed to Plato. So that this world where Aristotle is intelligent, and the material world, there is form in the material world, not often some other world. And the mind grasps that form in the images that we have of the material world. And that's the Aristotelian insight. And Augustine's insight is understanding giving rise to the inner world. And Aquinas put the two there. That's the argument that part of a long argument, the Verbum articles of Lonergan. Verbum is volume 2 of the collected works, and that these originally appeared as 5 articles in Theological Studies, 1946 to 1949. The concept of verbum, word, in the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas. It's the basic Thomist, it's his reading of Thomas. But anyway, that's a long answer. It departs a little bit from the question in the ways, but that's the Aristotle part of it. The mind grasps forms in images. Insight into phantasms. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break or so, and then we'll come back and we'll discuss the details.